Good to see everyone. First off, just to reiterate, on behalf of Yorktown Zen, our profound appreciation for you giving us a home to practice, to a place to be. You might also be interested recently, you plant seeds and other things open up. As our group has continued their practice and deepened their practice, we are now growing in kind of interesting ways. You know, one of the challenges for Zen in America has been, since its inception, it's been way too white and way too middle class. We just don't have a lot of Black or Hispanic leaders, Zen masters. And that's something that's perplexed us for a long time. You can't snap a finger and make a Zen master, obviously. But one of the issues we think is maybe the accessibility to practice, right? So I put a challenge in front of our sanghas. Maybe we need to go to underserved communities and just give them an opportunity to practice, a place to sit, to meditate. So within the last month, entirely led by membership, we've started two groups, one in Peekskill and one in Ossining. Again, like here, completely free, for people just to come and practice mindfulness and meditation. So if you trace back the karma of that, the cause and effect, part of it has to do with the fact that you have opened your doors and enabled that development to happen. So whether you see it or not, it blooms and continues to be of service. Complicated times require complicated thinking. The times you've kindly invited me to speak here before, the talks have been somewhat light and entertaining, I think, and charming and maybe inspirational. With your permission, I'd like to go a little bit deeper with you today. And it's interesting because the talk we have on koans and puzzles is one of the most nuanced and interesting, unique aspects of Zen practice. It's one of those things people joke about and have no idea what it actually is. In part of our American culture, we talk about, for decades now, they say, as Doshin said in the advertisement for this, if a Zen priest comes and no one shows up, did he really speak, right? So it's that old thing we've all heard, if a tree falls in the forest, did you actually hear it? It's actually based on a Zen, a very serious Zen koan. What is Zen koan? Zen koans aren't actually part of Buddhist tradition. In the very, very beginning of Shakyamuni Buddha in ancient India, there was none of this. Buddhist teachings were very straightforward. But somewhere around the 8th and 10th century in China, there was this desire to address some of the more complicated aspects of human spirituality and thinking. And then it was introduced in Japan in the 12th century. And the purpose of the koan is essentially to say, look, as human beings, we're all conditioned through evolution to think about things in a very certain way. All of us think about the world not because of our unique, spirit. We were conditioned to think the way we think. Our response to everything we do has been conditioned for many, many, many generations. You think, it's a unique quality. It's not. It really is. We've been conditioned. So in this training, at least within monasteries, the Buddhist teachers, like, you have these monks coming in. You want them to have this deep wisdom, but we have to somehow crack this conditioning so that their mind opens up to greater realities and the greater nature of things. So they develop a system of questions, that really challenged that conditioning, particularly around, and this is a big challenge for us as Westerners, around rationality. And we think that we can rationally kind of figure everything out, but rationality is a human creation. We created rationality.
And everything a human being has ever created is faulty. I think you all agree with that. Everything. We haven't created anything perfect, including rationality, including logic and truth. I love, did Pam do all the selections today? Fantastic. That's wonderful. We think we have a concept of what truth is, justice is, what love is, but that's all conditioned. Really think that, we've been conditioned to think that way. Yeah. So the purpose of the koan is to be so perplexing that it all shatters and then a new reality emerges. Right? If we were to remove all conditionality, our true nature would exist, and that's the only thing could exist. It took all of that covering away. Right? And that's the purpose of the koan. And they're tough. They're really tough, some of them. This is just one collection. There's hundreds and hundreds of them. This is the first one called The Gateless Gate. Right in the title is the perplexity. How do you have a gateless gate? And all of them propose that kind of perplexing thinking. So I want to look at a couple with you, and then I want to see the real-world application of them. It's not just theoretical and feel good. It's about our lives. So I'm going to give you, if you came to the Yorktown Zen or Monastery, the very first koan you would have after you were sitting for a number of months and comfortable with your meditation. The very first koan you would be given is called Sui Sokukan. It goes like this. In Japanese, you would say, Sui sokukan o sanjite orimasu. What it means is, I am now going to perform for you the breathing koan, the breathing puzzle. Now, the way we do it here is, if you come on a Saturday, everyone's meditating here, and then the separate room, usually upstairs, the student will come one at a time and propose these, do these koans for the teacher. It's the only time it's one-on-one in Zen practice. Everything else is done as a team. The student always leaves. So the student come in, sit in front of the teacher and say, I'm now going to perform for you the breathing koan, or answer for you the breathing koan. Now, the secret to every koan, figure out the koan, is to become the koan. If you just, there's a bell next to the teacher. If you just say, well, blah, 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 you're going to get the bell and be dismissed immediately. Immediately. You have to be that thing that you're talking about. Only by being it can you understand it. Yeah. So when you come in, you say that, and then what you do is you just sit there and breathe. What's curious about this is every living thing in the world knows how to breathe except human beings. It's very weird how we've forgotten how to do this. So when people come in, and you say breathe, what I generally see is people sit there and go, that's not where we breathe. Why don't we know how to breathe? So all of you have pets, or many of you have pets, you have a dog or a cat at home. They're your best teacher. So go home, watch them when they're napping, and you'll see exactly how we're supposed to breathe. As they lay there napping, the breath drops in through the entire body effortlessly, fills up the whole body, and then effortlessly is released. We're supposed to breathe. But all of us are up here, so the oxygen, we're not oxygen in our blood, the breath really isn't dropping down here. If you're a singer, you know how to breathe, because they train you to do that. It's up here, which means we're not tapping our energy, we're not tapping who we really are. And you can only begin that by the breath. That's why it's such a fantastic reading day about breath. It's all about breath. And breath is the only thing that's real. I mean, think about this for a second. If you were to stop eating, how long could you live? 2 weeks. If you stop drinking, how long could you live? 3 days. If you stop breathing, how long would you live?
2 minutes.
So of all the things, it's all about the breath. All about the breath. So we always return to the breath. So I'm going to invite you right now, sit down and do Sui Sokukan. Feel the breath just drop down here. And when you do that, all of a sudden the body starts to work the way it's supposed to work, and the mind calms. Blood pressure drops to where it should be. Mind becomes clear. At home, I have a blood pressure cuff right next to my cuff. Slap it on, take your blood pressure, and then just leaving it on, breathe for 2 minutes, and then press it again. You'll be astounded at the body returning to itself when it should be. So this is the foundation. Breath is everything. And I invite you again, throughout your day, to stop when you're stressed out, when you're cooking, whatever you're doing. Say, am I breathing right now? Am I really breathing? Okay, give 3 seconds and center myself and get the breath down there. So I can really be here and now and present, whether it's cooking or talking to another person or gardening. Our lives are in the present. Let me get present. Rather than thinking about a million things I should be doing. How much of our day is spent thinking about things you should be doing? And we're not here, actually. How much of our life do we spend not being in our life? And the beautiful thing is, breath, which we all have, brings us back to our life every moment. It's an incredible blessing. That's the first point. And typically in our group, it could take months of going to what we call Thoughts on the One-on-One, of looking at the breath before people go, oh my gosh, now I'm breathing. For the first time in my life, I'm actually breathing. It's dropping in naturally and calmly and deeply. I'm feeling relaxed. Energy is flowing. And my darn cat and dog knew this all the time, and they never told me. Right? So you have these teachers at home. Just keep, look at them. They'll teach you. So once people pass that koan, they go to the next one. Typically, the next koan is called the Mu koan, Muji koan. In Japanese, you say Muji no koan o sanjite orimasu. And the story that people have to solve is this. The story is a Zen monk once said to his teacher, Master, you have taught us that all beings have the Buddha nature. But does a dog have Buddha nature? To which the master replies, the Japanese would say, mu, or nothingness. Nothing. So the question is, what does he mean? This is one of the most profound koans. They say if you can solve this, you actually enter the first state of enlightenment. And not many people solve it. I've been modest here. People work on this for decades. That's okay. Because it starts to nurture the brain to think differently. How can somebody have something and not have it at the same time? Yeah. So, again, it sort of starts to crack this simplistic, rational approach that is very common for human beings, which is natural. But there are times in life where a simplistic view of things doesn't land us in the right place, doesn't help us. And although the koan's purpose is not to resolve political issues or social issues, that's a side benefit. Let me give you an example. How can two things be true at the same time? We have this in our teaching. Everything is nothing and nothing is everything. We chant this on a regular basis. It's crazy if you think about it. How can everything be nothing and nothing be everything? Same. So let me give you an example, a real world example. If we go back to the previous century, let's say theoretically there's a country that says we want to expand our power. We want to be bigger. We're not, some things have happened, we're not happy with our national identity, we want to resurrect ourselves, and the population is very unhappy, and they democratically elect a leader to resurrect the country, and they actually rebuild, and they get bigger, and in the process they decide, you know, what we need to do is kill a lot of people in the process. So here's a group of people, let's start massacring them to make ourselves stronger. And there's some gay people, let's kill all of them. There's some gypsies, let's kill all of them. And they get bigger and bigger and stronger and stronger. Now, you're looking across the water and you're thinking, what am I supposed to do about this? Where do I stand? Well, I think it's pretty clear what we're talking about. And as a country, we took a moral stand. This has to end. These people have to end. This is not acceptable. Morally bankrupt. We suited up, we got our armor, we went over, and we killed the Nazis. Destroyed the Nazis. Not before they killed millions of Jews and millions of gay people and gypsies and everyone. But we did the morally correct thing, correct? During that time, or even now, if I were to say to you, well, maybe not. I mean, after all, let's think about it, whether it was democratically elected, first. Those people had legitimate claims and they were very unhappy. They put them in power for a purpose. So maybe we should go back and not be so harsh on the Nazis and just like have a conversation with them to figure out emotionally where they were coming from, that they thought that was an okay thing to do. And by the way, Hitler, he didn't want to be a dictator. He wanted to be a painter. Right? He went to school for painting. He wanted to be a painter. Maybe we should have a conversation about why society doesn't make a place for artists to fulfill their natural talent and have to revert to being a dictator instead. And by the way, all those Nazis we killed, they had parents, right? They loved them, right? Maybe we should have a conversation about why it is that they were conditioned in such a way to think that that was an okay thing to do. We should have a conversation about that. And all those Nazis had families. What about those poor families? They lost their loved one when we killed them. What about them? What about reparations to them? What about, as you said, you know, as we had in our reading, you know, when you just destroy them, you create resentment there. So when we're doing the good thing by creating resentment and loss in all of those communities, like, does anyone want to stand up and make that argument? I don't think so. We're very comfortable, I think, generally, destroying the Nazi movement. Right? Are we?
Yeah,
I think so. Well, let's come more modern. George Floyd. Right? Is anyone here willing to say, you know what, that poor officer, I mean, think about his family and how he had to be brought up to think that that was an okay thing to do. There must have been a lot of abuse in that family that he thought that that was okay. And his family, you know, was obviously abused by his conditioning. Poor guy. Right? In society, and by the way, you know what? We're talking about officers killing black people. More black people kill black people than white people. Why are we blaming this guy? If white people kill white people. Like, let's just have peace. Everyone, we should just stop violence, be peaceful, let's give the guy a break. Let's give everyone a break here and have a conversation. Is anyone going to have that position yet? I think we're all pretty comfortable with where we came down there. Yeah. This day. So that has to do with moral clarity. By the way, UU. Look at the UU. Came to a point in the Scouts, as you know. I've been involved with Scouts for many years. Josh, Eric. We're all very proud Scouts. But there came to a point where the Scouts said, no gay people. No gay people in our organization, but leaders, no kids. And the UU was very clear. We're not going to be involved with that organization. Wait, why? By the way, the Scouts are a very complicated situation. It's not all decided by some executive committee. That's a fairly democratic organization. It was the membership across the country, the sponsors that all said, we don't want gay people. Like the people who were in the organization said, we don't want any gay people in our organization. It wasn't the top brass. They were just reflecting what the survey said. Right? Fair. It's their organization. Can't they make that decision? You said, we won't have anything to do with that. And withdrew. I think everyone knows that history, right? Until it changed. And there are some people that I think were brave, like Josh and Eric, and myself and other friends, that say, we're going to stay. We're going to be agents for change. We don't agree. We're going to be agents for change. We're going to stay. And eventually, it did change. And you came back. Because I had moral clarity at that moment. Correct? So we come to a complicated time now. Actually, I don't know if anyone heard that story at NPR this morning about how it sucks to be a clergy person right now. Just like, what are we supposed to say, right? So you have a situation where an organization says, our goal is to kill every Jew from day one, when they were founded, to this very moment, and there, like what Maya Angelou says. When someone tells you who they are, you should believe them. They told all of us, and they did it. And they came in, massacred, and they would have massacred a lot more. You know, we're getting ammunition now and stuff. They would have done everyone if they could have. And then they react. So then the question is, where did we come down on that? It has been very perplexing. Because you have some people saying, it's just like George Floyd and Nazis, and it's absolutely unacceptable. I mean, they need to be destroyed from us. There is no universe in which that is acceptable. So whatever it takes, they need to be destroyed. Right? So there's this absolute moral absolutism on one side. And then you have a lot of books on the other side, like, wait. All the violence has to stop. It's violence after violence after violence. Put down the weapons, put down the funding, let's just sing Kumbaya. And yet people on both sides. What about poor Palestinians? Right? So it's really hard. Where are we supposed to be on this? And it gets even more complicated. This is so complicated because there are people in organizations, in my experience, that I have supported financially, energy, time for a long time since their inception, like Black Lives Matter. There's no doubt about where I stand on that, except that the day after the incident, they come out and say, Israel got what it deserved. I have a problem with that, personally. So what's my relationship now to be there? That's complicated. Or you have a hospital bombing, and one side says, here's all the evidence. They blame each other. It's unclear about how many people perish. Right? It was your fault. No, it was your fault. It was your fault. Well, here's the evidence. No, here's our evidence. Like, which truth is the truth? And no one could be persuaded. Where are we supposed to come down with that? Individually. Individually and as an organization. What are we supposed to do with that? And it gets more and more. Every time you talk about this, it gets more and more complicated. Even yesterday after our Zen group, someone came up to me who's also very involved with the Scouts. And I said, I'm trying to sort through all this. And I said, I'm going to be here tomorrow. And they said, well, you know, it's kind of interesting because the UU was really clear with the Scouts where they stood. But trying to be a gay person in a Muslim community, what do the Palestinians, Hamas, and all these people have to say about gay people? They don't let them not join. They just kill them or not exist. So what's our position there? Are we still going to just sort of say, kumbaya, it's all get together and peace. Like, where's the moral clarity there? That's a hard one, isn't it? again, it sucks to be a clergy person, right? How are we supposed to, like, make this, figure out our way through this? And again, it gets, every time I don't know, these conversations have not stopped for me for the last 2 weeks. Very complicated, very upsetting. Now, this is where this practice of koans comes a little bit useful. Because as human beings try to make things simple and try to take a stand one way or another, because that's the way we get through our life, in the Zen koan practice, what we learn is the absolute and the relative exist together at the exact same time. It's hard. The relative and absolute at the exact same time. To say the murder of this particular group of people is absolutely unacceptable. We are going to kill all the Nazis. We're going to kill the people that massacred these people. At the same time, to say, yes, and there are other conditions that created this. And yes, it is relative because as a bird flying over top of the whole situation, it makes no sense. Right? And looking at it from Mars, it's all nothingness. And all of those truths exist exactly at the same time. So we're conditioned to think that evidence and truth and reality, you know, sort of the proof that the hospital is bombed by the other side, all this proof is being put forward, and they're saying, well, obviously they're lying on this. No, they're not lying, because that's their truth. We only think that logic and rationality and evidence is the only viable truth because we're conditioned to believe that. Other people don't believe that. That's not the way they're conditioned. So their truth is just as truthful. That's crazy to think about. It's either yes or no. No, it can be yes or no at the same time. It could be a gateless gate. It could be everything and nothing at the same time. Our practice helps us understand that wisdom. That's the purpose of the koan. Try to create wisdom. So, it's very emotional, very complicated. But that's why we're very blessed to have a cushion. And we're very blessed to have a breath. Because in these times where it's hard to know the path forward, hard to get the moral clarity, hard to know what we should say, it's a really good time to sit, breathe, and have both the absolute and the relative exist side by side. Not side by side, together, the exact same way. And there's not many spiritual practices that do that. Most spiritual practices help us just be happy and have some simplicity, and focus, and calm. But in complicated times, it's hard to know what are the techniques and the way to find that. Because if we just say, look, peace, 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 let's stop the war, we lose the moral clarity that enables us to stop the Nazis, to stop people killing George Floyd, to stop people murdering babies, right? That requires moral clarity. We have that on both at the same time. That makes sense? So this is our, the last couple of weeks, what we've been working on specifically. It's a challenging time. I'm thankful that, you know, people say this whole situation is a koan, a Zen puzzle, and it certainly is. There's a relative and an absolute vision of what's happening. And if we only take one or the other, we're gonna come up short. And that's what on NPR, the story this morning, that's what the clergy were all saying. It's like, well, we took this position, we thought it was right. Like, we took the position of peace. Well, you know, we should all just love each other. But then in deeper inspection, we realized, no, that's actually really, if we had just let the Nazis go, or the police force just do their own thing, just doing kumbaya, we're not really dealing with the evil and the destruction and the death. That requires action and commitment. Right? So, we have to have both at the same time. And that's our challenge. As leaders, as spiritual people, as people that have been gifted with life, actually make the world a better place. camera over here. So I'm happy. Probably thought this was going to be a simple talk today, but it's not a simple talk. And we're not taking sides. We're being in our life in this moment and dealing with the reality of what we have to do. That's our job, with open eyes. And looking the other way is also a privilege that I don't think any of us want to indulge in. We want to have open eyes and embrace life and embrace the challenges that we have while we're able to. So I'll just open it up for Dr. Thornton.